We'll call a meeting of the House Ag Policy Committee to order this morning on a beautiful spring morning. Have a full agenda, also have a presentation from Farm America, and we'll call those folks up to the table first this morning. We don't have a quorum yet, so we can't do the minutes or officially call any action. Farm America, good morning. State your names and you can begin your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bob Zelenka. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. I'm also the Chairman of the Board for the Minnesota Agricultural Interpretive Center, Farm America.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm Roger Steinkamp. I'm the Executive Director of Farm America.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to speak today about the Minnesota Agricultural Interpretive Center. The Minnesota Agricultural Interpretive Center was created by the Minnesota Legislature in 1978. At the time, two other organizations, centers were being organized, one dealing with lumber, one dealing with mining, and the ag community kind of coalesced and came together to insist on agriculture being represented as well in terms of a center being put together. This was shortly after the bicentennial, and that was kind of the impetus for creating those various centers around the state of Minnesota. The center is based west of Waseca, Minnesota, initially on 120 acres that was gifted to the center by a guy named Roy Lunkin. The center has at the present time a timeline that has been created over time. It's got 10 major points of interest, 16 various buildings on the site, a variety of buildings dating back to the 1850s. We've got an old church, a schoolhouse, a 1930s farm, a blacksmith shop, a feed mill, a visitor center that was constructed in 2000, which is the last appropriation that we received, additional appropriation from the state to build a facility. That was, again, the visitor center in the year 2000. We do receive state funding. We initially were receiving $250,000 annually from the state to run the center. It's over time, it has been reduced down to $115,000 annually as we speak. That's monies that are funneled through the Minnesota Historical Society, which is our fiscal agent. We serve, and I guess I should back up, our basic mission is to provide education, agricultural education, both past, present, and future. We have a lot of equipment on site, tractors, old as well as new, but a lot of old equipment that we have in part of a museum that we have on site. We do a lot of demonstrations during the year. We have a lot of visitors over the years. This last year we had 20,000 visitors. Of that, close to 3,000 of the visitors were students from various schools, from third to sixth graders. And I should have prefaced the fact that you do have in your packets some information on Farm America in a flyer that was distributed previously. So you do have that information, so I won't go through the whole thing. But anyway, it gives you an idea in more detail about Farm America. As I mentioned, we have served this last year about 20,000 visitors. They come from around the state and outside of the state, but we should be serving a lot more people with limited resources. It makes it difficult to do the type of marketing that's necessary for that facility. We also have, you can come on site anytime with self-guided tours. We have a cell phone arrangement where you can go to the various stops along the timeline that we have on site, and there's a recorded message about each of those sites. And we also have Tom Rothman is in the audience, one of our board members. Tom Haggerty is in the audience, one of our board members as well. If I'm missing anyone else, we have a lot of support from the ag community. I did talk to the Farm Bureau, Farmers Union, Agri-Growth Council, the commodity groups. We did get a lot of support from the agricultural community, and we certainly appreciate that. We also have advisory committees, and again, in the handout materials that we provided for you, you can see where there's two different advisory committees. We have a youth advisory committee as well as an adult advisory committee, if you will, that provides a lot of input and guidance for us as we move forward and establish our programs. In the handout, as I mentioned, you can see that there is current programs being planned. We do, again, school tours. We have springtime on the farm, summer celebration. We have farm camps. Farm camps, we have, again, that's geared to third to sixth graders, where they spend a whole day with us. We'd like to have that extended into multiple days where we could have some bunkhouse availability, which we don't currently have, a few things like that. But that's been very popular, and it continues to grow. We have a haunted corn maze. We have a 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, our corn maze was the top corn maze in the state, according to WCCO. And we also have the feed mill we use as a haunted feed mill. We have a local FFA chapter that gets involved in that. So we do try to involve the community as much as possible. We're generally run by a staff of two and a half or three full-time. We have a group of about 400 to 500 volunteers that participate during the year, providing when we have school tours, for example. We have various volunteers at the various sites interpreting each site and, you know, that type of thing. So without the support of those volunteers, it'd be very difficult for us to do what we try to do. Today, Roy Luckin, who originally gave us the original 120 acres, passed away recently, and part of his legacy is adding another 240 acres to the site. So we now have 360 acres on the Farm America site. And a large part of it, as you probably could tell, is still in farm. We do make some money in selling our grains on the market, and it's been a good moneymaker for us.
Maybe not this year so much.
Maybe not this year. Certainly not on the corn. But we do use some of the grains. We do plant some other grains that we use for threshing and some other activities that we have on the at the site as well. So maybe if there's something, Roger, maybe you want to fill in the blank that I missed here.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if I could just take 30 seconds to give you a vision of where this farm can go. I just came on a few months ago, and with the excitement that I never saw more opportunities and such a greater need for education and particularly interpretation, because we have such a diverse number or field of people producing food today, from organic farmers to large-scale farmers that are, you know, quite frankly, the public now has become more separated because they're more urbanized. So whether you're from the urban center or whether you're from a farm, there's a need for dialogue to get coherent policy out, to take us into the future, to help us understand each other. And, you know, and understanding is based on knowledge. And so Farm America gives you the opportunity. You know, some centers might take you back to 1850, but they don't take you all the way up to the drones, or I guess it's the unmanned vehicles that are scouting the fields, that you don't have to walk out there anymore. Things weren't always really nice back in 1850 either. And so it isn't Little House on the Prairie. It's a lot of hard work, and there's reasons how we got from there to where we are today. And on the, I just call it the farm, we're able to take you out and let you touch and feel. What was it like check planting corn? Some of you may remember that. When I was a little kid, we did. And so maybe it was fun going out on that old Alice and cultivating in the spring and getting a nice suntan so you could go back to high school and impress the girls. But it wasn't all that fun. And so how we got to where we are today, and combine that with the complexity of the world that we have today with a growing population, we haven't missed our mandate to feed the world, and we haven't missed our mandate to respond to the consumers, because there is a growing demand that we do things in a way that's acceptable to them. So all of these things come together to make this farm a very interesting center to engage, not only in one side or the other, it's all of us together discussing our way forward in producing our food supply and fiber.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to invite you and the committee to stop out sometime, have a committee meeting maybe, because I think there's a lot of people that have never been to the site as long as it's been there, and I would certainly, we're trying to do what we can to try to, you know, improve that communication with the ag community as well as beyond the, obviously, the ag community, and that's a real task for us, but we're doing what we can. Well, now we have Roger on board to kind of give it a good go, so that's all we had. I just wanted to just appreciate the opportunity to share with you what the center is about, that it's there, and we certainly encourage you to stop out and visit and check out and see what it's all about. Thank you, sir.
Very good, and we did visit about having a possible interim committee meeting out at the site, and we are still looking at that, and we'd love to. And Mr. Steinkamp, you paint a good picture. I didn't get in on the wire checking of planting corn, but heard a lot of stories about getting off every round and moving the wire over, and the, you know, it's amazing how agriculture has changed in these past 50, 60 years from what our parents and grandparents did to what we do today and what's going to happen in the future.
Yes, yes, Mr. Chair, and I think check planting corn, for those of you, you know, like you very aptly mentioned, you actually have to get out and move the wire. I did that when I was a kid. And also, it gives you the ability to cultivate two ways on it. That's the whole reason of it. But it's a lot of work. And also the yields and stuff. So if you can go out and touch and feel it, that's a completely different. And the reason I mentioned that today is that some of our guys in what we call AgriHall, these guys are old equipment buffs, and they're going to put some corn in like that this year. So come on out and take a look.
Very good. We're going to hold questions until after we hear the first bill on the agenda. So hold your questions. I think that may answer some of the questions you may have. We have enough members now for a quorum, so we will look at the minutes. We have two sets of minutes to approve for March 4th and again for March 5th. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the minutes on March 4th, where it says that House File 1235 was moved over for possible inclusion, and maybe you can help me clarify. I thought that you wanted to just lay it over rather than sending it to civil law. Is this correctly worded? Or?
No, Representative, you are correct. We did just lay the bill over, so we will make that correction in the minutes. The correction is duly noted that the House File 1235 was just laid over or held over. With that correction in mind, and we thank you for pointing that out, would you move the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the minutes for both days.
Motion's been made to approve the minutes for both March 4th and 5th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
And opposed, same side. Minutes are approved. First bill on the agenda is House File 1130. And again, Representative Johnson, would you care to move this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, I move that House File 1130 be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. And I'd like to just make a quick note. I just asked to be added as a co-author to that bill, too. Thank you, Mr. Cornish.
Thank you. And good morning, Representative Cornish, to your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 1130 is basically an appropriation to the Farm America through, like he said, the testifier, the Minnesota Historical Society. Typically, the Minnesota Historical Society has been the fiscal agent. Not really a representative of them, but just a fiscal agent to pass the money through every year. And as my testifier said, the money has been diminished from what it originally has. I've carried a number of bills. Surprisingly, the last time we had an infusion of money into the deferred maintenance, as this is requesting, was Chairman Knobloch, when he used to be here, in the last minutes of the legislature. Found, I think, a couple hundred thousand to put into it, and you should have seen the faces on the people out there with the shingles and the need of replacing and all the things that need to be done on these many points in this tarmac that goes around into the historical farm setting, how happy they were, because they operate with about three FTEs and hundreds of volunteers, and so they've been really good to do what they've done. Some of you might ask the question, why not bonding? We went all the way through the administrative offices up through the governor for an opinion, and they're not allowed to bond because of the way that they're organized. Bonding isn't allowed. And so what they have is basically the scant amount of state funding they have and pancake suppers and rental their halls and different things and donations to come up with the money. So that's why we're asking for $200,000 in 2016 and $200,000 in 2017 to help them along their path and take care of some of this deferred maintenance. And I'm not just carrying the bill, I also carry the idea. I've been out there many times. I go out there each year for the Fall Festival. They have these huge horses and a horse pulling contest with weight draft horses, and they have all this old type machinery done the way you said, and they dress for the period. You go up to this historical farm setting and the kids can come up and squeeze the apples, make apple cider, and see how cows are milked, and the shocking of grain and different things like that. So it's quite the system. And so I would just ask for your support for the bill today to move it on to the next committee and see how it goes.
Very good. Questions from members of the committee? Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, so I've been here for a while, and I remember serving on Jim Rice's committee and allocating appropriations from Farm America. I think it's been a good investment in the part of the state. I'm just curious, are there other agricultural interpretive centers like this, or how unique is Farm America?
Well, this one, Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, this one is organized 78 as the Minnesota Agriculture Interpretive Center, so it carried the state label with it. Now, I don't know how the Kelly Farm is organized and how they're funded, but that's another one in the metro area, I imagine, here or around this area. But that's the two that I know of. And I think Rod Searles, a former Speaker of the House, used to be on the, I don't know if he was ever the director, but he was on the board membership and really used to push this idea of funding from the state.
Representative Mariani, any follow-up? Representative Chair Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Cornish, thank you for bringing this bill forward, and I appreciate the testifiers, the testimony as well, when you're talking about the need for dialogue, understanding, education, knowledge, and that we're all in this together. And I like that. We're not pitting one part of agriculture against another. And the thing that's unique that about Farm America, or the thing that's important about Farm America, is you do not only talk about the past, but also the present, and then what's capable of in the future. And that in itself is exciting. Now, this is where I get on my little soapbox and asking for help, pleading for help. For all the members of our committee, the governor's office, the Senate, and the Department of Ag. I went back with staff and took a look at what the agriculture budget was at the turn of the century, 2000, 2002, and it was just shy of $150 million. And today, it's just shy of $80 million. We need to be investing additional dollars in agriculture. Representative Cornish, I can't thank you enough for bringing this bill forward, and let's work together to see if we can't, and let's work together to make this happen. Thank you.
Anybody in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1130?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Busselman, Minnesota Farm Bureau. Minnesota Farm Bureau has policy and support of funding for Farm America, and we wanted to come before you today to encourage your support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Busselman. Any other questions? Representative Cornish, any closing comments?
No, Mr. Chair, members, thank you for your attentiveness and showing up today, and just wish your support to send it on from here. Thank you.
It's a great facility. Representative Johnson, would you like to renew your motion?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly before I do that, I just want to give an endorsement to Farm America, too. My wife has worked for years in Waseca. It's an important part of the Waseca community. But in our part of the state, this is a regional attraction, and it's an important educational place. And I, too, have attended it, and I think I do encourage that. Let's have the committee down there.
Yeah.
So I then renew my motion that House File 1130 be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance.
And I would think marketing would be a part of the plan going forward to get the word out about what a great place it is and get more folks to come. Mr. Zelenkely, for the
I just want to mention, Mr. Chairman, if you're wondering, in the enclosure, there was an enclosure, that went into the deferred maintenance. If you were looking at and wondering about what we're talking about, there's a whole list here of items that, and we could expand this even further than we did, but it gives you an idea of the kind of deferred maintenance we're looking at here. I believe it was a yellow sheet in one of those in the Farm America handout that I mentioned earlier.
Okay. Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 1130 be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
And against, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Next bill today on the agenda, House File 532. Representative Rarick, would you like to move the bill?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I will move that House File 532 be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Very good. And as Representative Petersburg comes to the table, I believe there is an amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it in. And again,
yes.
Representative Rarick, would you like to move the A15 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will move the A1564 amendment.
Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. The amendment is approved.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill here is what I think is just a clarification of an error that has occurred over the last few years, and it's a bill that I carried last year as well, trying to eliminate the Farm America from being required to charge sales tax on the missions to their educational programs. Now, they understand that gift shop and all that stuff needs to be charged sales tax, and they've been doing that in the past. But they've always believed that they were an educational program and that they were part of the historical society, at least an unofficial arm of that, and so that they should be exempt from sales tax collection for their educational events, which is basically two primary events that they hold in the spring and then the fall, and one in the summer. I guess there's three. But the Department of Revenue, through an audit of their sales tax, has determined that they were indeed supposed to pay for the taxes for, collect sales tax for their admissions from this point forward. And so last year we put this bill forward trying to make sure that they were exempt. The tax chair decided not to exempt them, and instead Farm America was appropriated the dollars to pay the back taxes for that, and we're very grateful for that. Farm America is very grateful for that. But we're here again to just what I believe is correcting the policy so the Department of Revenue is directed on how to handle that. As an example, I had forth a presented this, and I think everybody should have in their packet something from me from the Department of Revenue that talks about the sales tax nonprofit exemption from there. And you'll notice that under educational organizations, I have two circled that I think they certainly would qualify under, if not directly in their name, well, certainly would qualify for them to be tax exempt. And as you know, the state created them through the Historical Society as a regional interpretive center, and they are getting appropriations from the state through the Historical Society as well. Again, where it is a non-state-owned agency, it still is directing a lot of work that the state has requested of them. So therefore, I think it qualifies as an exempt status. For further testimony, I'll turn it over to the other testifiers for further comments.
Just a quick question first, Representative. Looking on the second page of your bill, the effective date goes back to 2007. If you had been reimbursed or Farm America up to that point,
That was the amendment.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And unfortunately, I asked to have the old bill pulled forward, and I forgot that revision, and so that's the reason for the amendment.
Okay, very good. Go ahead, Mr. Zelenka.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Bob Zelenka, Minnesota Grain and Feed Association, also chairman of the board for the Minnesota Agricultural Interpretive Center. Yes, we were audited going back from 2008 through 2010. The determination was that we were more entertainment than we were education. We challenged that and had very limited success. Fortunately, as the representative mentioned, that we did get some monies last year to pay that past tax due. From this day forward, though, we would certainly appreciate a little clearer understanding about us being on a similar footing with the Minnesota Zoo, the State Fair, Historical Society, and others who are exempt from having to pay sales tax on admissions. We don't view ourselves any different in terms of what we do in terms of providing agricultural education. So we do appreciate the representative bringing this bill forward, and certainly would allow us to, garner what we can in terms of revenue and without having to face the tax man at the end. So we do appreciate your willingness to hear this bill.
Very good.
And if I might just add to that, in talking with Mr. Zlenka here about what the normal tax collection might be on an average year, he thought somewhere around $2,000 a year is the amount that we'd be talking about. And whereas it may not seem much to the state, $2,000 goes a long ways towards benefits and other program costs that we have at Farm America. So it'd be better not to pass that on to the consumer, and certainly it's difficult to make up that difference in their budget as well.
Chair Hamilton, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Petersburg, we talk about on lines 2.6 why Farm America was established, Minnesota's rural agriculture heritage, and focuses on educating the public about rural history and how farms. Is there any way that could we work with you on putting additional language in here to go back to what the testifier talked about, not only about what our heritage has been, but what we're doing here today and into the future? Because this is ongoing education, not only about where we came from, but where we're at and where we're going. So I'm wondering if you'd be willing to work with me, and we'll figure out some language to identify that as well.
Absolutely. Representative.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Good point, Chair Hamilton. Questions from committee members? If not, anybody in the audience who would wish to testify either for or against House File 532? If not, Representative Petersburg, any closing comments to your bill?
Yes, a couple of things. First of all, I would like to reiterate the invitation to anybody to come down and visit. I know a few of you have been there during some of the events, and it is really a great opportunity for you actually to see what it was like living in a sod hut in which you're underground basically with no windows in the middle of the winter. It's quite interesting to see how the landscape of Minnesota has been forged by our ancestors and those that have been here before us. So thank you for coming down if you can. And the other is just thank you for hearing the bill, and I appreciate your support.
Just a quick question. If somebody were planning to come down like I would like to watch the threshing of oats or wheat, August, the good time to plan to do that? What kind of a timeline do you have for your harvesting?
Mr. Chairman, that would probably for that I would think August or early September. I think we're starting to plan our planting so that it coincides. I believe that's what we're talking about.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Okay. Very good. No more questions. Representative Rarick, would you like to renew your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll renew my motion that House File 532 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Thank you. Representative Rarick renews his motion that House File 532 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevailed. Next bill this morning, House File 1187. And as Vice Chair Franzen makes her way up to the testifier table. We will make ready to hear this third bill on today's agenda. Of course, the deadline coming up a week from Friday, so we are meeting today. This is the usual Finance Committee date. We'll also have policy tomorrow, and maybe a night session or two before we get the deadline of next Friday. There is a department policy bill we're going to be working on, I believe, next week. So be ready that we may be calling an evening meeting to get those things in order by next Friday, March 20th. Next bill up, House File 1187. Vice Chair Franzen, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 1187 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices.
And do you have an amendment?
I certainly do, Mr. Chair. And I would like to move the A15 amendment.
And it doesn't seem to be a major amendment. Could you explain it to any?
Yes, simply we're just going to strike real property, insert residence, so that the bill flows nicely.
Okay. Any discussion on the A15 amendment? If not, all in favor to the A15 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted.
Great.
Vice Chair Franzen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill was brought to me from a constituent who is in the audience who will be testifying, but I am going to allow Mr. Elwood here to give you a little background on the equity stripping and how it came to be before I present my portion.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Thank you, Representative Franzen, for asking me to testify today, and not only want to provide some background, but also want to stand in support of House File 1187. What this bill does is provide the same protections for family farmers against equity stripping scams that currently residential homeowners have under Chapter 325 and the equity stripping law that was enacted back in 2004. So you might ask, well, what is an equity stripping scam? And this is essentially what it is. Where you have circumstances where homeowners, or in this case farmers, would have substantial equity in their homes, but at the same time are struggling financially and having difficulty making their mortgage payments, once a foreclosure advertisement is published, unscrupulous speculators will come to that homeowner or farmer's door and say, I'm here to save your home, and here's the deal. You deed me your home, essentially give me your house or farm, and in return, I will sell it back to you on a contract for deed or enter into a rental agreement until you get back on your feet, and then we'll arrange a sale back to you. Most of these deals were structured to fail. The payments on the contract for deed or the rental were too high for people to meet, or other conditions were imposed that they couldn't meet. And once the ownership of the property was transferred to the scammer, the homeowner, or in this case the farmer, would be unable to avail him or herself of the protections under our foreclosure laws, which provide sufficient time to either reinstate, redeem, or at least stay in the home and find a new place. Under a contract for deed, you could be out in 60 days after a default, and a rental as little as 14 days, you're gone. So once the homeowner would default, the scammer would simply evict, and they have the deed, they have the property, and is effectively stealing the home and all the equity away from the homeowner. So what this bill does, as you know, back in the early part of 2000s, when the foreclosures and the economy came together to create this situation, many people lost their homes, and this became a bit of a cottage industry. And in 2004, the Attorney General, Governor Pawlenty's office, the Department of Commerce, Legal Aid, and a number of other folks came together to pass overwhelmingly bipartisanly Chapter 325N. So again, what this bill does simply is to extend all the protections of that law to a family farmer caught in the same situation.
Mr. Elwood, quick question. Would this apply to the entire farm or just the house in 1 acre?
Mr. Chair, I think the way the bill is written, it would probably apply to the whole farm, because it does, counsel can correct me, but the definition of a farm is on Section 500.24, Subdivision 2, which I believe would be both the residence and the agricultural property around.
Mr. Sullivan, is that how you would interpret that as well?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, it is.
the Section 2, the language there on lines 1.15 and 1.16, has similar provisions in effect, I believe. So it's a real property principally used for farming. Whether or not the parcels are contiguous, so long as the owner occupies one of the parcels as the owner's principal place of residence. So I believe it would apply to the entire farm.
Okay, very good. Chair Hamilton, a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Branzner, maybe it's to the testifier. Help me understand, why wasn't this in law currently? First of all, thank you for bringing this forward. Secondly, why was this excluded initially to where farms did not apply?
Mr. Elwood.
Thank you for the upgrade. Mr. Chair and Representative Hamilton, I don't think it was a purposeful exclusion. I mean, at that time, if you remember back in 2004, you know, it was the home, the residential homeowner, the foreclosure crisis, and, you know, unlike back in the 30s when it affected farms and everybody else, and we've got the farmer lender mediation programs and all those sorts of things in the 80s too, you know. This was really focused, everybody was just laser focused on residential homeowners. So, frankly, my recollection, nobody brought it up. it was an omission, but not a purposeful one.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions by committee members? We have a couple more testifiers from the audience. Would you care to come down now, please? Good morning, sir. Identify yourself, and then you can proceed with your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm Attorney Richard Bossy from Henning, Minnesota, and I am the party who brought this to Mary Franson's attention. I enjoy a statewide practice in professional negligence, and as part of that, I enjoy a practice in lender's liability. The case that brought this to my attention is Mr. Roseland's case, who is sitting behind me. He is a farmer in Pine County, and part of his farm is in Carlton County. And he had, just as Mr. Elwood just eloquently described, the scenario of the equity strippers, who were a partnership of about four gentlemen, who came in and offered him on the eve of the redemption period, the end of the redemption period, that they would pay off the mortgage if he would deed the property to them, and he would get back a contract for deed for a period of 3 years. Of course, the contract for deed carried payments larger than the payments that he was having trouble making with the original institutional lender, and that was due to difficulties with the wife's illness. Of course, the scenario is he couldn't make the payments, and as a result thereof, he lost the farm. It's been litigated, and right now it is in the appellate court, with the court finding that there was an equitable mortgage. But that's not the point here. The point here, and the point that we're trying to do is to save the farmers from this, what I call creditors occurring, particularly in the eve on. When people are in distress because they don't know what to do. Not only did he live on the farm, and it's a farm that I understand that he inherited, but the larger portion of he combined during his lifetime from his savings. It's an 800-acre farm. At the time, the creditors loaned him $420,000, okay, to pay off an existing mortgage that had been in foreclosure. And they picked up a $1.2 million piece of property. That's by an appraisal that they had made, a professional appraisal they had made at that time. Besides Mr. Roseland living on the property, he has two children, married children, who also occupy homes that are on the property, right, in farms that he had purchased to put together with this farm. This is a real problem. It's not just unique to him. He's given me names here this morning of three other farmers that he knows of in his area who have faced the same situation. Now, being a trial lawyer, I know, and I suggest to you that farmers are a breed that get embarrassed when they get in a situation like this. It's kind of like the elderly when they get taken advantage of. They don't like to talk about it a lot, and they don't like to bring it up a lot. But it appears to me, being out there in the bushes, so to speak, and on the street, that this is occurring now a lot more, because we are having, as I think the committee is aware, a tremendous increase in the value of farm property. Just as happened here with Mr. Roseland, where these equity strippers were able to make an $800,000 farm.
Have another testifier, Representative Franzen?
I do. We have Mr. Roseland, who Mr. Bossy has referred to.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Welcome to our committee, and state your name and then proceed with your testimony.
My name is Ken Roseland. Mr. Bossy was accurate. I live in Pine County with some land in Carlton County. I really can't add a whole lot to what he said. It's absolutely accurate. My understanding is that this statute 325N protects counterparts in the city or village, and their housing is protected under this law. But the language is not clear in this 325N to protect farmers. We'd like to have a clarification. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Roseland. Any other questions from members of the committee? What about audience members? If not, Representative Franzen, any closing comments to your bill?
No, but as you can tell by, well, yeah, I guess I do have closing comments. as you could tell from the testimony, can you imagine saving up and buying your dream, owning a farm, and come into some financial difficulties, and thus your dream dissolves because of some unscrupulous people who want to take advantage of those that are down for a certain amount of time in their life. And so I hope it is the committee will vote this out so the bill can continue on its path, and I thank you for allowing me, Mr. Chair, to bring this bill forward for my constituent.
Thank you for bringing this bill forward. So Vice Chair Franzen renews her motion that the House File 1187, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say same sign. The motion prevails. Is Representative Quam in attendance? I don't see him here yet. We could maybe put out an APB or something and get him down here. Could we move ahead to Representative Marquardt's bill, then, if he's ready? Next bill on the agenda is House File 1230. And Representative Marquardt, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I will move House File 1230.
Representative Marquardt moves House File 1230 to be referred to the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division. Representative, would you like to present your bill?
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. This deals with the Conservation Reserve Program, and it deals with a little property tax item. But before I do that, I think everyone knows what the CRP does, but I don't know if everyone knows that it became official with the Farm Bill of 1985, signed by President Ronald Reagan. You notice I'm representing a Republican president here to win a little favor with the committee. But as we know it, so it celebrates, Mr. Chair, it's celebrating its 30th year. And so, like I said, people are, they know about that program. What the bill does.
It's been a good program, too.
What's that?
It's been a good program.
Yes. And what the bill does is very simple. It just says that agricultural land, if it's in CRP, would be considered agricultural land, even if it wasn't that before. And I had a person who came to me that had lost his homestead on his CRP. And he had homestead on the rest, but he lost it on the CRP. And so we think this might deal with it. I don't know for sure, but the basic premise of the bill is that if you have agreed to put your land into CRP, at all times it should be considered agricultural land for property tax purposes. And so I think that's all this does. This was sent over from Senator Eakin, who was also working with this same gentleman, and this is what they thought would be the solution. So I'm open for questions.
Representative, I was just looking at some CRP regulations on the drainage issue. And to get land into the CRP, it has to be on the federal side, crop for 6 out of 10 years. So when it goes in, it is ag land. So I agree with you, it should stay ag land in the tax classification.
Right.
Yeah. Questions on the bill?
Yeah.
Chair Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the way I'm reading it here, if it was classified 2003 or earlier, it would be considered ag land. Do you know, Representative, what changes made in that time frame? Why not after 2003?
Representative.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, I don't know that answer for sure, and I don't know if there's anyone from staff that could answer that. And I don't know a lot of the history behind that. I just know that this person ran into problems that all of a sudden his CRP was no longer considered agricultural homestead.
Yeah. No, Mr. Chairman.
Chair Hamilton.
Well, thank you. Representative Marquardt, I didn't know either. I was just curious the history around all that. Thank you for bringing this forward. It makes perfect sense to me as well. So, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Anybody from Department of Revenue here that could comment on this type of issue? I don't see anybody. Questions from anybody in the audience or other committee members? Seeing none, Representative Marquardt, any closing comments on your bill?
No, Mr. Chair, I just ask for the support and appreciate giving this a hearing. Thank you so much.
Representative Marquardt renews his motion that House File 1230 be re-referred to the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
And all opposed say no. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Okay. We are still trying to locate Representative Kwame. It's a busy time, and he had other bills up this morning, so he will be here. We're going to take hopefully just a short 5-minute pause when we try to round him up and get him in here. He has a couple of bills, which again shouldn't take too long. A couple other tax bills to be re-referred.
Mr. Chairman,
Chair Hamilton,
are we in recess then for 5 minutes?
Sir? Yes, we are.
All right, thank you, Mr.
Yeah, I know.
When I first saw the bill, Kent brought it over to me, I just didn't know if it was solved it or not. But then I was talking to Steve Hines and with the House Research, and I said, will this impact Homestead? Because that's what he said. Yeah, he could. Because it could get the world vacant land. And so he said, so I was thinking if it doesn't, then the bill doesn't do what I want. But Steve Hines said, no, he said it couldn't. So that was this morning. So that's what I don't know a lot of the history of it.
If it doesn't quite, maybe we could even change this a little bit, or you could introduce something that's a little different.
Sure. Okay, thanks.
Yep.
We'll call the meeting back to order. And give you a second to catch your breath, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a short pullout with about 14 local teachers. And we went around the corner. And apparently the discussion was energetic enough to stretch long. And I apologize for that.
Ooh, now we... Next bill on the agenda, then, is House File 287. And Representative Hoppe, would you care to move House File 287 to be referred to the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division?
So moved, Mr.
Thanks,
Chair.
Representative. Representative Quam, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this came about because of meeting with several farmers. Because of the evolution of the tax structure, older farmers have tended to put their farms into family, limited liability, LLCs, and other instruments so that it'd be protected when it passes from one generation to the next. The other thing that happens is that it's fairly common for an older farmer to rent out their property. And if you add in that maybe in the 80s they had to sell off part of the land to, the family sold off part of the land. Now, if that farmer who spent his entire life farming that farm lives in that property, lives in the house, but it's not physically connected to the rest of the land, he rents out that land, so now he goes through the annual questionnaire. He doesn't qualify as being a farmer because he doesn't have the risk. He doesn't qualify for the special homestead credit because he's not contiguous to the rest of the land, and the farm is in a LLC. And what this bill is to address is you've spent 10 or more years farming that land. You should not have to qualify as being a farmer. And it allows for the state, if you hit that, the same standard for regular, homestead credit of if you're within four townships or four cities of that property. So it's not going to cover somebody that's living in New York or another state. You're still local. And that's the whole intent of the law, is to not make them annually, prove they're a farmer, and allow them the treatment of property taxes as a farmer.
Representative, you mentioned that if they rent out the land, they would have no risk in the operation. If they sharecrop rented that land, would that change that situation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had one constituent that fell under this, and my suggestion was rewrite the rental agreement so that part of your rent comes and is dependent upon yield, so that you have some of that inherent risk of farming. But this is aimed at people that are retired and older, and sometimes all these hoops we dance through are a little bit difficult and complex for them, so I'd like to take away that burden.
Okay, very good. Anybody, any questions from committee members on House File 287? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Quam. I think you're getting at something that's a problem in the countryside, and I'd like you to go to, I'm curious, though, how you decided about the owner living no further than four townships or cities. Townships I can picture pretty well. I know what the size they are, and that's pretty straightforward for me. But four cities, that's more confusing to me. And then also related, why you chose townships or cities as opposed to, like, miles away or something like that.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, because that is in other parts of statute. It's I'm not sure when they chose that as a way of defining, so I didn't want to recreate something, so I had the revisor borrow it from existing statute. We have the most complex property tax system, and everybody I've talked to says that. And within that complexity is that definition. And so I wanted to be consistent with existing to make it simpler to implement.
Follow up, Representative? So along those same lines, if the towns are 5 miles apart or 15 miles apart, the distance wouldn't matter, just that it's four towns. Correct, Representative?
Mr. Chair, that's correct, but townships, they're, what, a mile square?
6 miles square.
6 miles square, you're right. So that gives you an idea of the general distance if it was townships. And when you're in the country and tillable land, your farm might be stretched a ways.
Hey, Representative Poppy, did you have a follow-up? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I guess I'm confused. So do those combine? I just need some help figuring this out. So if I had a farm in rural Nicollet County and I ran across, I had a township, and then I ran across the town of Nicollet, and then I had another couple of townships, then the town of St. Peter, and then is that how it works? Or?
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is the or it can be used between the town and the township, but the four is universal, so it'd be a combination.
Okay. Representative Hoppy. Poppy, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions, maybe along the same lines as Representative Johnson. I think I'm just a bit confused as well. That section seems to be a little cloudy. So if a person on that combination of the townships and cities, I guess I'm wondering if you were to not have that, obviously, then it's anywhere. If they lived anywhere, that they're able to have the ag designation. But is there, to me, that it just seems like that this maybe needs to be cleaned up if we're going to move this forward, I think. But in addition to that, I just had a question about think how I can phrase it here. So if the family member, so this is the property and this would be the designation for this property owner, and that means that no one is currently living on the property, and so it's not being used by anyone else, it's just now land, is that correct?
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, that would not be correct. The land is, what it gets to is non-contiguous. If you're forced because of our tax structure to put your farm into some sort of an instrument to convey it to the next generation, or allow that option, you know, now you have to be contiguous. For if you didn't have that, this same farmer could be doing everything else the same, and they would be under the rules of four townships, four cities. And I think at some point they said within a that worked out to be reasonable to be able to drive equipment, you know, back and forth to run your farm. The only two reasons why this bill is needed is one, we're forcing the farmer to have a document, a instrument to be able to convey it because of our tax structure. And two, farming is not always roses and great crop prices. There are hard times, and it is common to have property sold and the farm not be contiguous. If either of those two things weren't present, no farmer would have to suffer through this. And there aren't a lot. But when I look at a farmer in his late 60s telling me that now, because he doesn't qualify for the special homestead credit, the property taxes are going to double. They're going to be more than the income from the rent. And now the farm that he grew up on, that his dad had to sell some of it off to keep a farm going, he has to liquidate it because of he doesn't have continuity between the farmhouse he's living in and the actual tillable acreage.
Follow up, Representative Pompey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe then it just goes back to number five here. If you did not have that, how would that change? How would that change the bill? You didn't do number five.
What do you mean by number five?
Oh, I'm sorry. And
Mr. Chair, 3.8.
Page 3.8 to 3.12. It's the description about the owner lives no further away. I'm just trying to figure out if you can, without having out-of-state owners, I guess, I'm just trying to figure out if there's a way to do it simpler. It seems kind of, even though maybe this is the way it reads now in other parts of the statute, it seems like it just, maybe it's just me, but I'm having a hard time trying to figure it out. And just wondering if you didn't have that, is there another way to be simpler with still maybe meeting the same criteria that you're looking for?
Well, the language you're pointing out is new language, but I think the Representative Quam's point, a lot of this is already contained in other statutes, and I think what you're getting at mainly is just not having the farmer have to fill out that form every year. Is that correct, Representative?
Mr. Chair, that's correct, plus making sure that they don't lose that special. This is existing for regular, not special homestead ag credit. So basically, if they've been farming for 10 years, then they can use the same standards as you would for regular homestead ag credit. The special comes in if you have an instrument to be able to, convey it to your next generation.
And I think we're getting into a lot of tax questions here that will be more fully vetted further along the path that this bill would take. It will be referred to taxes and the property tax division. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think that helps me a lot. Yeah. I think the point this committee needs to make, and I see this, if I'm understanding this right, I fear too often because of the rules, and I don't understand the rules that well, too often elderly folks are forced to live out in the countryside when they really should be in town. Mm-hmm. And we need to be looking at ways to promote the appropriate livability of people who own a farm, or in whether in this fashion or a different one, to live near that farm, but not necessarily on that farm where they have less access to transportation, emergency services, and fellow folks with whom to communicate in their daily life. So I think that's what this bill is trying to do. So in that vein, I think it's a pretty important bill.
Representative Kwan?
I was just going to agree with that, and that's, I think, why the four-township rule was about. It was to allow a farmer to live, maybe in town and still be able to run the farm.
Because there is a huge difference in the amount of taxes one pays if you're homestead or not. Representative Hamilton and then Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it was years ago, living out on a farm 3 miles west of Comfrey, and my wife took employment in town. And along County Road 1 in the wintertime, it's terrible. And so here my wife and children were at risk every time they were going to town. We made a conscious decision then to move to town, and then I would do the driving back and forth back then for that reason. And so it goes down a little bit down the path that you were talking about as well. And Representative Kwan, just food for thought, why do we limit it? Why do we limit it on townships, four townships or four cities? Why do we limit it? We can harvest wheat from Texas to Minnesota, and I understand being confined within the state or whatever, but why do we put a limitation on it? Just food for thought.
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hamill. I wanted to make this the least change, least difference. So I utilized existing. Yeah. If I had my druthers, and a little bit of that is in the next bill of looking at revamping. This we need now. The next bill and the revamping is going to take a few years to work out. But, we do the steps we can do to make things fairer and better for our people.
Hey, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Chair and members, and Representative Kwan. I think I certainly like the direction you're heading here. When I look at this, I think the major difference from the current kind of the homestead versus what you're doing is you're taking out the person who is actively farming. So it just really depends on, looks that way, it looks like it just depends on the owner. Where, like, there's the one part under the part two, where that's that relative homestead where the owner, the owner's spouse, or grandchild, sibling, or parent of the owner, and then is actively farming, you can still keep the homestead. And then on part three, you've taken out the person who is actively farming has to be a Minnesota resident. So basically, the owner is within four townships, but the person actively farming wouldn't have to be a resident. And then the current portion says neither the owner nor the person actively farming can live more than four townships away. That's current. And you're basically taking out the person actively farming. Is that, I mean, as I'm kind of looking at that, the summary doesn't necessarily say that, but it seems like, which I think might be the right way to be moving that, if they're renting land, it really shouldn't maybe matter where the renter lives or how far away or whatever. It still should come down to the owner. So I agree with that. But just to understand it, it looks like that's kind of what you're doing. Otherwise, everything else is really the same.
Representative Kwan?
That is a portion of it. You got to remember, it might not be the children. It might be the grandchildren. And you might end up have farming's more complex. Yeah. So often they'll go off to college for a few years. And maybe this is a temporary rental thing. Yeah. But it gets down to the fairness of somebody that's been involved with that farm, or that's a family farm. And to a greater Minnesota, a family farm means something. And this is to protect that and maybe prevent some encroachment by outstate or corporate farms from gobbling up. So I'm trying to make it reasonable and fair for farmers and protect family farms.
And I appreciate the comments from Representative Marquardt. I think that helps all of us to understand the direction we're going here. Any other questions? Members of the audience, questions or comments on the House File 287? We have another testifier. Good morning, sir, and identify yourself and proceed.
My name is Tom Diving. I'm Houston County Assessor, and I'm the chair of the Ag Committee and also on the Legislative Committee. And maybe I can help clarify the four townships.
Please do.
Yeah. And that's in law for, say, a person owns a farm, and he owns, multiple farms. And you can go out those four townships and give that person homestead. Once you go beyond the four townships or cities, you end up going non-homestead on the rest of your farm acres. So it's language that's in law currently, and I think that's probably where the four townships or cities is already in place. So,
Mr. Chairman.
Chair Hamilton.
Mr. Chairman, and to that point, why four townships?
Well,
how was that ever decided?
Sir, go ahead.
Chair and Representative Hamilton, that's in state statutes. So it was created at some point, and maybe to the answer that was already given, you know, maybe it was looked as kind of a homestead and far enough to go out, and if you're beyond that, then they go non-homestead.
And Mr. Is it Diving?
Diving. Yep.
And when we're talking homestead, that's at that 0.5 tax rate. That's
correct.
What we're referring
correct.
To. Correct.
Yep.
And there's an upper limit of about, $2 million of valuations, correct?
Yep. And it's gone up quite a bit in the last few years based on the average tillable land in the state of Minnesota. Yep. So, yeah, it's up over $2 million. Okay. The one thing I'm concerned a little bit about is the ownership of 10 years. When you look at the summary, it says sometime in the past. I think you need to differentiate maybe if it was the last 10 current years and you know, you could be out there 20 years ago that they owned it for 10 years and stuff. So, you know, that would create some issues. And obviously, as difficult as the property tax system is because of its, you know, difficult and a lot of laws that are created, why, you know, it'd be nice to kind of keep it simple. I mean, part of our issue with the Assessors Association is to try to keep things simple and understandable for everybody, which is create some issues, obviously.
Did you hear that, Representative Quam?
I did hear that, and the attempt was to keep it simple, and I didn't want it. I would have an exemption language for if someone went off, maybe the son of the farmer went off and fought and, you know, was in the military, and we've had a long conflict, so you could be 10 years, and then you're gone for 10, you come back, you know, for 2, 3, and you've got that farm. Instead of looking at all the reasonable exemptions, I thought start out this way, and then we get the property tax, we'll make it just as complex as the system forces us.
Okay. Thank you, sir, for the clarification, and thanks for your work. Any last comments on House File 287? Representative Quam, any final comments? So with that, Representative Poppe, would you like to renew your motion that it be referred to the property tax and local government subdivision?
Yes, Mr. Chair. That is my motion.
That's the motion from Representative Poppe. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. House File 287 as will be referred to the property tax and local government finance division. Next bill on the agenda, I believe that's our last bill for the day. And it's House File 1212, and Representative Lewick, would you care to move this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would move House File 1212 to be referred to Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division.
Representative Quam, you're kind of a regular here, so go ahead with your bill today on House File 1212.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the previous bill is something that I felt needed to get done soon. This bill
is to open up a discussion. You know, we need to have a new property tax system. I likened it at one public meeting as the old farmhouse. I grew up in one where it had like four or five additions you kept adding on to it. Our property tax system is if you had a farmhouse with 60 or 80 additions, and you're walking along and hallways would just sort of dead end, or you'd trip because you had to step up 6 inches or 4 inches. It just is cumbersome, and I think it's reached a point of where you tear it down and build it from new. In order to facilitate that, this bill has a couple of discussion points. The first is that you've worked your life, you've got your home. Why, when you retire, if you have a modest home, should you be paying property tax, the rent to the government for your home? And arbitrarily, we picked the average home value of 150. We could do it average home or 80% of the average home in a county. But that's a discussion to address in the property tax and the long discussion that would go to work that out. But that's just a principle that I think has come up and I felt was worth discussing. The other one is there's always contention in ag land valuation. Multiple sites have different opinions. And part of it is because if someone in the township does a development, plots it out, sells it, that sells for a lot of money. And, you know, frankly, if you sold your farm, most farmers would have a lot of money, but then they wouldn't be farmers. So what is fair valuation for tax purposes for somebody that's trying to farm? And there is a coefficient or some factor of, and I can't remember the three letters now, but it basically is what is the production, crop production capability of that land. And that is supposed to be one of the factors utilized in calculating the valuation of farmland. But I don't think that's been that universal. So the thought was the ag extension offices, if they're collecting the data and you have honest, accurate data, ought to be able to come up with the prevailing tillable land rental rate for that county and a pasture land rent prevailing. In other words, have a multiple of what would be the productive, the output cash-wise from that farmland, and have evaluation based off of that. This bill, if it ever was to become law, would be vastly different. This is meant as a starting point, and it's the principle of what's fair to someone that's worked their life and is now retiring, and what is a fair way to evaluate the ag property. And that's what I want to go forward to the property tax committee and start the tussle over. And it'll probably, you know, I might not be in legislature when the end result is, but if we don't start that discussion, we'll just continually add on additions and get even more complexity to our property tax.
I would certainly call your bill ambitious. The topic of property taxes is a huge topic, a difficult topic, and your attempt here to base that on rental income is, I think, used. South Dakota uses something like this where they value their land for tax purposes, but it's a big change, and I applaud you for bringing it up, and it needs to be looked at, but it's a big undertaking. Questions from committee members. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam,
if I'm trying to understand this a little bit better, and what could be some of the downsides of this? If I am an aging landowner and I'm looking to sell, and I have a young beginning farmer that is renting the land, would I be more inclined to force that rent up so that I can increase the value of my land right before I sell it? Would that be possible in this bill? Would that be one of the negatives or one of the downsides to this bill for a young and beginning farmer? Just a question that I have, if land value is based on rent.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hamilton. This is for the purposes of property tax evaluation. Whatever you sell your land for is what the market will bear. And, you know, and frankly, we were getting phoned-in bids from Nebraska and other states buying up our family farms when they go for sale. So it wouldn't affect what your sale price would be any more than what prevailing rental rates might be. Okay. But this is aimed only at property taxes. And it does have a green acres clawback that if you sold it for something outside of farming, that then there would be a larger stake pulled back, because I realize this is a good thing for farmers and a bias. So then the catch is that when you cash it in for non-farming, there'd be higher proceeds coming to the taxing entities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No follow-up?
Okay.
We have some more questions. Representative Johnson is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you again, Representative Quam. This is hard for me to understand the dynamics of that. I think Representative Hamilton, the unforeseen circumstances are hard to sort out. But the overall issue that you mentioned about the farmer selling their land when they're faced with higher taxes and that, I'm going to take advantage of this opportunity. It's something I've been concerned about for the last couple of years, and I hear a lot from family farmers in Nicollet County where there's a lot of farms that are 130, 150 years old, and selling the farm is really not an option. I had a farmer in the other day and said, you know, my family's been farming this land for 130 years, and really all of these adjustments on ag land prices and you know, the increase in land, he said, yes, I certainly have more wealth in my family because we've appreciated that, but it's unrealizable wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think somehow we need to recognize that. I don't know where to go with that, but I think it's very valid, and especially in my part of the state where we have a lot of really older farms. And I can imagine the pressure on that family because they literally can't sell it. And on a personal note, I can relate a little bit to it because I own a very small tree farm that's been in my family for only about 45 years or about 40 years or so. But what makes that hard to sell, maybe not impossible, but very difficult to sell, is my father built all the buildings by hand in a very old-fashioned way. So that these homesteads, and when we're talking about a homestead with a small H and family farm, it's not only the value of the land, it's not only the value of the enterprise, there's also the social value in terms of the family and the history of that I don't think can be overstated. I don't know how we build that in the law, but I think it is a subject that we need to keep working on and see how we can adjust policy to recognize that. So thanks for your indulgence.
Along those same lines, Representative, when I was getting my taxes done this this year, I got discussing the situation of retiring, getting out of farming. Yes, I'm getting that old, Representative Schumacher. And the tax man said, when a farmer retires, you usually have some extra grain to sell and some income coming in, but you don't have any more expenses. And then if you sell your land, you're going to be hit by capital gains tax. And he said that he has actually told some farmers that you cannot afford to retire because of the tax implications of capital gains mainly, and then having income without any corresponding expenses to offset some of that. So it's a huge issue, as you bring up, Representative Johnson, and one that we aren't going to solve today in this committee, but the property tax certainly is a part of that, and it needs to be looked at. Representative Lewick, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
a little follow-on to that same concept. You know, there's kind of a two-pronged approach there in farming. If you've been at it a long time, you can't afford to sell and you can't afford to die. I'm seriously. Let me say that again. You can't afford to sell and you can't afford to die, particularly because of that capital gains issue, which is a federal issue as well as a state issue. But one, I want to thank Representative Quam for bringing this forward, because we need to start a huge discussion here about what we're doing with property tax on ag land, because it just gets more complicated, seems like, every 2 years. But these are questions I just posed so that we kind of got them down, because at some point they'll have to be answered. I get really nervous about rental rates, and the reason I get nervous about rental rates, where I live, we did very little corn and beans. But let me tell you, when the price of corn went where it did here, people came in and no-tilled right into pasture land that we were renting for $15 an acre. They're gone now. It's all back to pasture land, just in a matter of a couple of years. So the volatility there, and then you put that into context that property, you know, that market value you're paying on this, you're paying taxes this year on last year's market value. So you've got a 12-month lag to begin with. So that's just it. I put that out as a question about using rental as a sort of a ratio, and that's, we're starting to move closer, and I don't want to go there. I want, this is for the record, when we start to play in that arena, we're starting to look more like we're trying to push toward let's just throw in the towel and let the assessors do this on a commercial business basis, as opposed to the way we deal with ag land. And we do not want to go there, at least I don't. That's a whole nother process there, how you determine market value on a business other than a farm. Completely different ball of wax. Then the other thing, and again, this is really pulling the string on the rental thing. I've been thinking about this a long time. We had discussions earlier. Another example of the diversity, at least where I live, we've got sod farms, and they're unique. I don't think any of them are under a rental situation, but that's unique. Right next across the road, we got rice paddies. I don't think anybody's up there renting rice paddies in my country, but if you were to do that, I'm not sure how you would determine, what's the market value? And if there is no rental up there, what do we do then? But to go a little further, we've got pasture land. We had corn and beans. It comes and goes. It depends on the price, because we can't produce at the level that the folks to the southwest of us can. So the price has got to be way up there before we're going to be able to make it pay on our acreage. But then we've got a huge amount of straight forage land, where we're rarely going to break that ground for any reason. And a huge amount of that's rented. And then throw in organic. You know, you've got some really specialized stuff. So that's where I just, in the interest of not making it more complicated, those are the kind of questions I'm afraid that we would have to answer if we picked any particular ratio, and would it, so I say I just raise them. I don't want to make it more complicated. So certainly there's no answer to these right now. I think we both know that. But those are the kind of things that I think as we go into this discussion, we need to, you know, we're probably going to have to satisfy them. If it becomes too hard, we might need to just completely turn and go to even something much simpler. I don't know. But I just raise those as examples in my area that would, you know, as an old county commissioner, would drive our assessor's office crazy. Let's put it that way. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, thank you, Representative Quam, because you are sinking your teeth into one huge monster here, but we need to start biting on it.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to take advantage of having the assessor in the audience. if he would be willing to come down. I just wanted to ask Mr. Diebing a question.
And he will make his way down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. I've always said it's Debing, but you said Dibbing?
Chair Anderson and Representative Poppy, you're using the Houston pronunciation.
Well, that's what I thought.
And
so
we are relatives, and it's Debing down in Houston, and Lanesboro, it's Dibbing. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good, because I thought, well, maybe all these years I've said it wrong, but no, Mr. Debing, thank you. Well, I don't know if you were here for this, in particular for this bill, but this is one that I'm just curious, since you did travel, I'm curious about the effect of, if this were in place, how that would impact your role.
I think...
Mr. Debing, go ahead.
Chair and members... I think it's, as Representative Lewick certainly mentioned, I think getting surveys for rents, and I think would be very problematic, and turning those surveys into a value, whether you'd be able to get the correct numbers that would come through on the surveys, especially if you learn that maybe a lower rent would be a lower value. I really have a problem with that. The way we do land is based on CPI or CER,
yes,
and that's corn productivity index, or the soil rating, crop equivalent rating, and whether you grow sod on it or corn or alfalfa or whatever, we value it based on the productivity of the soil, mm-hmm, and then we look at the soils and the relationship to the sales and the soils, and based on that, that's how we come up with the value of the property. So in other words, a property that has a high productivity rating would, sell at an X amount, why then we'd apply that number to the other properties in the county. And usually we end up using a sales study, and when you've gone by a farm or a house or whatever, you've looked at it and you said, well, they paid way too much, or they got by real cheap on it. So what we try to do is we put them into a sales study, and we throw out the tops and the bottoms till we get to the very middle one, and that's the one we use as our benchmark to change values from one year to the next. So that's how we currently do it, and I would recommend, obviously, to continue that. I know there's some states that do based on rents, but I find it would be very difficult to get honest rents, so to speak.
Mr. Debing, that reminds me of a question. And as you mentioned, people say, well, they paid too much and such, but can we account at all for speculators coming into a land market and paying more than what the land is worth in terms of productivity, based on pure speculation? Any way to account for that when you put the assessed value on ag land?
Well, Chair Anderson, obviously we'd like to take the speculators out of the mix, and yet they're part of the market, we don't differentiate between somebody that's a local farmer buying farmland, or maybe somebody from the cities buying it. The idea is that it's been put out on the market so that everybody's had a shot at it, and it's been publicly promoted, so everybody has a chance at that.
Could 1031 tax exchanges make land sell for more than it may be worth?
We do look at those 1031s, and we do use them to kick out of that sales study.
Okay. Okay.
Because they're a lot of times they're motivated. They're getting down towards the end of their term on their 1031, and they really can be really motivated to buy a property, no matter what it is, or at what price.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Representative Poppy, any follow-ups?
No.
Okay. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope I'm not getting too far off the topic here, but it goes back to your comments about retiring. Are farm sites and or ag land, are they eligible for reverse mortgages?
I didn't get into that. I would assume they may be, but I don't know.
I'm just curious. Okay. Talking about
Representative Schumacher, any comments on that? No? Okay. Anybody in the audience testify in favor of this bill? Anybody testifying against the bill? Thanks, Mr. Dibbing, for coming up and sharing with us today.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Inter-County Association. I consist of 10 of the greater Minnesota counties that include our regional centers and 4 of the ring counties here in the metropolitan area. I'm appearing in opposition to this bill. To start with, I'll note the irony here about the discussion of needing to simplify our property tax at the same time that you're considering a bill that will substantially complicate the property tax, as the prior one did. First, I'd just like to separate the issue of ag taxes and ag valuations from the issues relating to ag homesteads and ag non-homesteads. I've been associated with the state's property tax laws for my entire lifetime. 21 years as an analyst with the Senate Tax Committee and 15 years as a lobbyist working primarily in the property tax area. I've participated in the drafting of many of the statutes, and I quite frankly can tell you I could not tell you how to effectively or accurately classify agricultural property under the current scheme. I will suggest to you that there are probably many instances where it's inaccurately classified right now. It's so complicated. There's been a spreadsheet or a Venn diagram that's been shared with the tax committee many times that extends into several legal sheets that shows you how to classify properties, and it's just incomprehensible. And so have substantial concerns about this. Really, to address the issue of classification, just simply get rid of the distinction between homestead and non-homestead. It really has no meaning under current law, because the existing general perception that homestead is a property that you occupy no longer applies under the state law. You make so many exceptions to it. As I said, you might as well eliminate it. Now, with regards to this bill, there are several provisions, at least one of which has not even been identified for the committee, that we have concerns about. The first is in Section 1, the exemption of non-productive rural vacant land, what's called Class 2B, which has a class rate of 1%. This would be eliminating over $9 million of tax base in the affected counties. And the effect of that means that taxes goes up on everybody else in that county, in that school district, in that township. And we are against that. There are already provisions in the law where this property, if it's associated with the homestead, can qualify for the state's rural preserves program, where the valuation is limited to its wild state without taking into account its development potential. And for timbered property, it could qualify for the state's Sustainable Forestry Investment Act credit.
Mr. Carlson, could seasonal rec land fall into that category as well?
Mr. Chairman, no, it does not. That's a separate classification.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, going on to Section 2, I'll just indicate, as is true with every provision in this bill, there are already either provisions that address the issue that could be modified without significantly complicating the administration of the property tax, or in this instance, been there, done that. Back in the 1980s, the Department of Revenue was required to do a survey of cash rents and use that in guidance to the local assessors for valuing agricultural properties. Within what I recall, and your staff can better apprise you of the exact parameters, that scheme was abandoned. So we've been there been there before. It really didn't help with the valuation of these properties, and I'd suggest to you that the same thing will happen again. Section 3 is particularly complicated and, frankly, onerous for an individual who chooses to convert his farm to a residential or other use. It's a substantial penalty. It goes far beyond the penalty that's imposed under the current Green Acres and Rural Preserves laws, where the difference that is imposed has a penalty for taking the property out of ag production or rural preserves is just the difference between the tax when it's taxed solely on its value as ag land and the tax what it would have been taking into account its valuation. This taxes it on the difference between it being ag land and commercial property, which is a factor of fourfold, substantially greater, and I highly suggest to you that you don't want to do to this. Finally, with regards to Section 5, the senior homestead market value exclusion has somebody who's approaching the age who would qualify for this. I would suggest that many of us, such as myself, don't need this. When I retire in 2.5 to 3.5 years, my income is going to be greater than what I have in my working that I'm earning in my working life. There's no means test here. Many seniors can afford the taxes that are imposed on them because they're at one of the most lucrative portions of their lives. We have many programs that address the issues for seniors right now. We have the property tax refund for seniors where one member of the household is age 65 qualifies for a refund for taxes that exceed, depending on their income, from 0.8% to 2.5% of their income. Those refunds can be in excess of $2,600. If you want to provide further relief to those individuals based on some reasonable qualification, I suggest that's the program that you want to do it. We also have the separate senior citizen deferral program that effectively freezes the tax on the property for those individuals who wish to apply for it and is made more generous under the governor's tax proposal. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Mr. Carlson. Question from Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the testifier, you know, your knowledge and your expertise and also with your direct involvement over the years, one, how did the tax system get so complicated? And we understand you've shared what is wrong with Representative Quam's bill. If you could just once again reiterate what is right with the bill or what suggestions that you have in order to correct this debacle.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hamilton, as I stated at my beginning, I think you have to separate the administration of the property tax with regards to agricultural property and its valuation and its taxes. The latter, I don't personally think there are any great issues. You can address it through the existing mechanisms that exist out there, such as the agricultural credit, the classification system, or possibly through a state-directed refund. The administration of the property tax, whether a property is agricultural homestead, in which case it qualifies for a 0.5% class rate, or agricultural non-homestead, in which case it classifies for a 1% class rate, is what occupies an extraordinary amount of our greater Minnesota assessors' times, or even many in the metro area, trying to determine what is the appropriate classification. If you simply eliminate the distinction, because as I suggested, it really is a distinction without meaning because of all the exceptions that have been put into the law, you would substantially simplify the administration of the system. You would have to deal with the fact that there would be property tax shifts from the non-homestead to the homestead land, but the current value of property that qualifies for the homestead for this assessment year is over $2 million. that captures a huge majority of the land right now. And again, it's just gotten ridiculous as to what we have in the current law, trying to make a distinction between the two. When you no longer use the owner occupied and farmed as the basis of determining that distinction.
Go ahead, Chair Hammond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I understand that it may simplify the admin side. However, if we did away with that homestead, non-homestead classification, what would be the impact to the individuals who are currently homesteaded?
Mr. Carlson, quick answer.
Mr. Chairman, without no other changes in the law, it would increase the taxes on ag homestead and every other property in the affected jurisdictions.
Any other questions? If not, the Representative Quam, any closing comments?
I think we all have a lesson of just how complex this is. And this bill is meant to reach the Property Tax Committee and foster a energetic debate at how we could make things better. And I'm not saying I don't have the hubris to say this is, but I knew this would kick the hornet's nest.
That it has. Representative Lewick, would you care to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would renew my motion to for House File 1212 to be re-referred to Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division.
Representative Lewick renews his motion that House File 1212 be re-referred to the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails, and the motion prevails. Good meeting today, and the meeting is now adjourned.